Neil Jones is with us in the Wellington studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Trish Sherson is in the Auckland studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Neil was Chief of Staff to the then Labor leader Jacinda Ardern, prior to that Chief of Staff to Andrew Little. Director of Government, Capital Government Relations he is now. Trish is from the corporate affairs firm Sherson Willis and is a former ACT Party Press Secretary. Right, I don't expect miracles from you today because...
It's like the first day back at school.
It's a little bit like the first day back at school. We're going to have a short class and then we're going to run around the playground. Let's look at what... I didn't think the Prime Minister would do catchy announcements out of Labor's caucus this year because the year of delivery sort of became one that wasn't.
a millstone, really.
However, the year of the vaccine, he's hoping she's not tempting fate, because what we're seeing overseas at the moment is a mad scramble, frankly, to get enough of this stuff, to get it properly coordinated, to get people vaccinated, and one has the sense that New Zealand may have to fight hard to hold its place in the queue. How important is the management of expectations and then the management of however this thing is going to unfold this year, Trish?
Well, I think you've hit on some key words, and actually this is, if I were the Labor government, this is what I would be focusing on this year, and that is the correct management of expectations. You know, as you've rightly pointed out, the year of delivery was a huge failure because it overhyped everything and there was no management of expectations. To give the government its credit, where it did really well, and the Prime Minister particularly, in the initial COVID response is because day by day at those daily briefings, she managed all of our expectations around sort of timing and what was happening. But this year, you know, and the we'll come on to the vaccine in a minute, but housing was one area with their first announcements. There was no management of expectations, and it was a sort of a announcement about a reheated announcement about social housing, which was actually masquerading as a solve for overall housing affordability. And the government has to start to manage expectations that these are two totally separate things. On the vaccine, again, and this is just what I'm sort of hearing from people around the traps, that there is a feeling that there is not enough upfront communication from the government about what is it exactly is going to happen with the vaccine rollout and when, and a feeling that there's real transparency around that. And I think the position that Kiwis are in is that, you know, they are very, I think, sanguine now that they're in a holding pattern, but I think what a lot of people don't fully understand with the vaccine is that it is not a silver bullet. So, yes, what we know about the vaccine so far is that it might prevent you getting very sick, but the evidence is still out on how much it will prevent transmission. And also with all of the vaccines developed, no one yet knows what their efficacy will be on these new and worrying strains out of the UK and South America and South Africa. So that's my pick for the year, is the year of managing expectations properly, and that requires honesty and bravery and courage. And the vaccine and our border MIQ facilities are certainly two areas that are going to require immediate focus.
Neil?
I think the three big challenges this year for the government are COVID, rolling out vaccination, and what we do with our borders. The second one is housing, and the third one is climate change. And I agree with Trish, the housing start to the year wasn't great. I think it was an issue around expectation management. The risk you face with housing is people say, well, is that it with anything you announce? Because it's such a big problem. And I think sort of announcing a rehash of an existing policy probably wasn't the way to go. In terms of climate, but I mean, there is more coming, and they'll have to have something reasonably large come sort of the budget or just before the budget, because if they don't, I think it becomes a real credibility issue if house prices keep rising, and it will undo any legacy around tackling inequality they may have. The second one is climate change, which I think is going to be a major challenge this year. We've got the first Climate Commission report coming out on the February the 1st, so in a few days, and that is going to be very challenging. It has to be challenging because we are so far from being able to meet our obligations. And so while last term was a term of setting up the infrastructure and the framework of climate change action, this term is going to be one of actually putting meat on the bones. And that's going to be quite challenging, and the government's going to have to work very hard to bring the public along with it. And then on terms of COVID, I think we have to be a little bit, have things in perspective, I think. Every day at the moment you read in the media that it's some kind of disaster, and I should point out here I have a conflict of interest. I have a personal connection to the Minister's office. But I think if you look at where we are in New Zealand, we've had a whole summer where we've had basically complete freedom. We live entirely without restrictions. I mean, I had to wear a mask on a plane to Auckland last week, but that's about it. And I think we need to just sort of recognise we are doing quite well. In terms of the rollout, we're not, because we're doing well, we're not in that same position as, say, the US and the UK, who have had to rush out the vaccine before they've had complete data. We don't know the full details on the efficacy, side effects, etc. And I think it is, given vaccine hesitancy is a major problem for the uptake, I think we are better placed to be able to actually wait and make sure that we have it done right. Because it's not just anti-vaxxers. There are a lot of well-educated, informed people who are hesitant. And they may not be right to be hesitant, but it does exist. And so I've got members of, you know, friends and family who have expressed to me that they sort of want to wait and see. And so I think we've got to make sure that we don't rush it out and get it wrong.
Trish, I don't think there's any risk of that in some ways, the rushing out and getting it wrong. I think the risk on the other side of it is people saying, why can't our border workers and managed isolation people get it earlier than April, you know, in March, April, when Australia, for example, is looking at an earlier rollout in February? Now, I don't know whether Australia's going to achieve that earlier rollout, because I think we're only beginning to learn how the demand for this by bigger, powerful nations is going to affect everyone else on their expected timelines. We don't know. And the government's being very cautious to say it'll start counting its chickens when the vaccines arrive. But if Australia is trying to fast-track the vaccinating of its MIQ and frontline workers, it would make sense, wouldn't it, for New Zealand to be trying to piggyback on that or cooperate on that? We're the ones talking about trying to have a bubble with them, Trish. This is the kind of pressure that's going to build.
It will, and you know, that the MIQ infrastructure and the frontline workers associated with it that we've seen time and again through New Zealand's response, that's been where the issues have arisen, because it's the real pinch point, right? And it does seem to be a no-brainer that if we are able to secure the vaccine at the earliest opportunity, you would get that frontline vaccinated. But again, I think that's important to remember. You know, what that will do is lessen how ill our frontline workers might get from the vaccine, and potentially the viral load that they will have. But it's not a silver bullet for transmission, and that I think is a bit that's really missing in a lot of the upfront conversations. But I also thought over the holiday, you know, that this getting frontline workers vaccinated, it's also similar to what we've seen over the holidays around now testing people before they get on the plane. So, you know, credit actually to Judith Collins and the National Party. Way back, I think it was in June last year, that was their big, sort of one of their big policy planks, we should be doing that. And the answer was, oh, well, no, that doesn't do anything because people still have to come through the airports, etc. It's sort of like the U-turn on masks. And I think, you know, this is part of the thinking around this whole response that we kind of have to get better at if we're going to preserve our position, is that you've got to throw everything at this. And it's almost like a wide funnel. If you think about coming to New Zealand, if you can test them before you get them into the funnel, then you're going to lessen people on those flights who are infected, etc., etc., and it just trickles down.
Australia halving in some states, I think, halving the number of people it's prepared to take from high-risk places. Now, I know there's human rights issues over people having the right to return, but we already manage the rate of return. The other matter is, are we requiring people to stay at home for a week after they get out of MIQ and don't go on a national tour? I'm not referring to this latest case. This person has clearly done everything you could possibly do with the tracing app, etc. But is that advice being given, at least given, of people leaving MIQ to give yourself another week's buffer?
Yeah, and I think we don't know enough about this case yet whether that's necessary, but, I mean, it can't hurt to do that. The other point I would make is your one, that we need to look, I think, at reducing the number of people coming in. And I know there are human rights issues around that. There will be, the government will be taken to court if they move on this. But the reality is, I don't think you have a right, a moral right, to come back and infect other people with a deadly pandemic. And secondly, as you say, we already are managing numbers. And as we have increasingly virulent strains and the virus rages out of control in places like the US and the UK, we're getting an increasing number of people turning up with it. And no matter what we do in terms of pre-departure testing, which frankly is pretty hopeless, I mean it's a small part of the answer, but it's a very small part, we actually have to reduce the flow coming through, because as we know, no matter what we do on MIQ as a country, we're not going to be able to stop outbreaks, because, you know, this is something that someone got off a bin lid at one point. Someone got it off an elevator button.
But you may reduce the number.
Exactly.
So and the frequency.
So the more people we have presenting, the more outbreaks we're going to get. And I would have thought that it would make sense to look at reducing the number of people coming through. And that would be hard politically. It may be impossible or very hard legally. And it would also have some blowback in terms of things like cargo, for example. I mean, it would have an impact on New Zealand's ability to import goods, possibly export goods. So there are a lot of issues around that, but that's something we do have to look at seriously, I think.
We already pay for the goods to come to some degree in air transport, don't we? Routes have been kept open by the government directly paying the airlines, but I take your point. We're talking massive volumes of freight, reduce the number of humans coming in, that's going to impact on the
And it might be harder to get your ASOS, but that might be a price we have to pay.
And I would agree with Neil on that. And actually, if you just think of the quantum of numbers already who have gone through MIQ, I think that the latest number I saw was over the weekend at 92,000. I mean, that is a huge load on a brand new system to try and get through. It's almost a year ago since our foreign minister stated in absolute black and white that now was the time to come home. And I think with these new variants, it does add more weight to that argument to be more stringent around reducing the numbers. But also, the other question is, how frequently are our MIQ facilities being audited now, and in what shape does that take, particularly given the new variant? So, you know, I think it's, and I'm not saying this has happened at all, but if you look at New Zealanders' response overall over summer, because we have been in this fortunate position, we've pretty much put it to the back of our mind, and you would want to think that those MIQ facilities with the new variants are being kept absolutely on their toes and systems all the time reviewed and stepped up because, you know, just one of stories from a person I had met with over the holidays who'd been in MIQ, and when they went to have their fitness each day, you had to sign out on a form with a pen that you were going to exercise. So imagine that pen as a vector for spreading infection. So, you know, it is those tiny, it's like anything, it's human error that will cost us our gains. So you would just want to think that there was ongoing auditing of those facilities.
Especially after the buried report came out from Brian Roach and from Heather Simpson right before Christmas, which we saw right before Christmas, and which the Parliament still hasn't formally received or had a chance to discuss. Again, you know, there you've got two pairs of eyes who are exactly of the detail volition that you're talking about. And that kind of, we cannot be talking about those kinds of failures after the event again, Trish. And I think the other thing I would love to see change is that inclination to keep saying things are okay when they're not. I wish we could just speak up and say something is not as it is and we're on to fixing it. Let's not have officials feel like they have to BS ministers because the news won't be welcome. Don't know how the, what was the word that was used? The dissonance between what Cabinet thought was happening and what officials were doing actually happened. I still hadn't got to the bottom of that.
But this comes back, isn't it, to that management of expectations, which is actually about honesty and transparency, because New Zealanders now are so conditioned to the situation that we're in. we really want the truth. And the
that's up to politicians. Sorry to interrupt you, Trish. That is up to politicians to end this years-old facade now.
Yes.
That you have to politically massage every damn thing that happens.
Well,
that you can
never
leave a minister exposed with anything that might look like bad news until it's long been fixed. We need to grow up and let officials and let experts tell us hard truths and let the public hear them, because that is part of the complacency.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And actually, at a time like this, you need those hard messages to come through unfiltered so that you get the action that you need.
All right, let's look at other aspects then. So we, housing, of course, doesn't go anywhere. The question is whether Labor moves at all from its, the government moves at all from its solid position of no new taxes. We've had the debate over whether an extended bright line test is a new tax. It is a CGT in effect. The extension would make it a CGT in effect, becoming effective perhaps for the first time. Do you see them doing anything? Are we going to continue this business of, oh, Reserve Bank, could you give us a list of ideas? Do you see them seeing a moment where they can move from the pledges they've made?
I think there would be a justification, given the rapid house price increases we've seen as a result of the COVID stimulus from the Reserve Bank. And I think they could argue with credibility that the world has changed since the election, which is, if you're going to do a backflip, you have to be able to make a serious claim that the facts have changed. I don't know, to be honest. I hope that the government, that Jacinda Ardern shows the leadership she has through COVID to really speak bluntly to the public about the crisis we have, the massive social crisis around housing and what needs to be done, and it needs to be bold and big. The question is, as I've said before, if you did any polling or focus grouping, any action to reduce house prices or to stop the growth is electorally very damaging.
And you've got 2.5 years to survive it. You've got 2.5 years to survive it and make the moral argument and let kids make the moral argument to their parents and grandparents.
The point I would make is it's not easy. I don't want to be one of these people who comes on here from the left and says, oh, they should just, you know, do all these radical left policies, because I would like to see them do it. But I also know that the realpolitik is very, very difficult on housing. And when you look at it, there are these three crises just Jacinda Ardern has to bring us through: COVID, housing and climate. That is a huge test of leadership. She has to win on every single one of them. She has to bring the public with her on every one of them.
She's got actually more time on climate than anything else. It's the irony. Who thought climate change would be the easy subject? They can, you know, they are going to get some really hard information from the Climate Commission on February 1st, and that's going to be shared with the public, and then a softening up exercise begins. But she doesn't have to be announcing a policy in the May budget. She's going to do housing, she does.
The problem that we have with climate change is that every year we delay taking action, the harder it gets. And so, you know, we should have been taking action 10, 20 years ago on climate change. We're that far behind. So, but look, in terms of housing, I think she will do something. She has to do something. The question is whether she takes the boldness. And the risk she faces as well is, while there's electorally it's very damaging to move on housing, to not move and to go into 2023 election and say, oh, I haven't done anything about housing.
$2 million house
there are lots of homeless people and housing's out of control. Okay. That's not credible.
And you can't blame it all on COVID. Trish, let's just have a look at the opposition and how it begins the year. I think all I saw on TV, and to be fair, I was so logged out, I wasn't even looking. So let's
join the
fair
club.
So really, I think I saw the brief outcry over the not having the annual cannabis plant raids by the police. And I remember thinking,
the Wiggles being locked out, yeah, that was the other big moment.
Let's be fair. The unfortunate thing for National, among many unfortunate things, is that this is often a time of year where, really proactive opposition spokespeople can get a lot of mileage because nothing's happening. But hey, it's 2021 and no one was listening. What do you see about their opening sort of, you know, ambits this year, and what it says about working out who they're going to present National as being?
Well, that I think is still the big question that they have to figure out. Who are they going to be, and what does that mean, and who are they actually talking to? There was some good consistent stuff over the holidays, bits and pieces I picked up mainly through my Twitter alerts. But you know, Chris Bishop just hammering away on MIQ and keeping the blowtorch on the bum there, which I thought that was good work. I really had a question mark over the that is the reason in all seriousness I raised the wiggle stuff, because you know, I don't think that at the current situation we're in, you know, that is the biggest issue that we have to face, and it sounded like those guys hadn't got themselves organised around MIQ, which is not New Zealand's problem. But I think, you know, where is the sort of scene setter piece from them that is going to set out the course for the year, and how do they quickly make that look different? And as we talked about at the end of last year, that the things that I would be most concerned about if I were National is actually ACT and how their year is going to shape up and sort of suck the oxygen away from National, and then obviously the big elephant in the room for National will continue to be rumblings around the leadership this year, and who and how they try and set themselves up for next year and potentially positioning ahead of the next election, because as we know, 3 years goes round really quickly. So I think for National there is, you know, it's a really hard road ahead this year to convince themselves internally that they know where they're heading, let alone the rest of the electorate.
Yeah, I mean, Judith Collins has a State of the Nation speech tomorrow, apparently. She emailed me this morning. I assume others got that email. And she basically said she'd be looking at economy, housing, gangs, COVID. But, I mean, I haven't got a sense of a strong message that cuts through it all. And I think the problem they face, apart from having a very unpopular leader, is that they haven't done that hard work in opposition of working out how the world changed after their term in government, and what they need to do to move with it. And I think part of that stems back to the point that they never really thought they lost in 2017. They were sort of a temporarily embarrassed government. And so they have to really do that soul-searching, work out where they stand and what issues they're going to push on. And I think one of the big problems they have as well is that when you look at the issues the government's under pressure on around housing and climate change, these criticisms are coming from the left. There is a left-wing critique of the government, but where the public are wanting, sort of asking questions, I don't think National are providing the answers. And so they've got a bit of work to do to actually make themselves relevant. Because if you're not relevant, that's the most damaging thing in politics.
But isn't that a bigger question for them, actually? And this is back to, you know, focusing on the cannabis raids is a good illustration of that, is, you know, I think the electorate has moved on at such a pace and is in such a different place now that I'm just not sure National's really got a handle on where that is. And
in
where
fairness,
their,
they probably
where
got asked
is.
And fronted up and spoke, and it was Simeon Brown, I think, speaking.
A rare misstep from Simeon.
We're kind of back to where we were at the end of last year. What is a Conservative Party's policy suite and presentation in 2021? Not in 2005, not in 1995. What is it now? And I, you know, I know they're doing this review into what happened at the election. That's the palace politics stuff, which is a handful enough. It's more fundamental. Mm. Who are our voters? Mm. Who are going to determine whether or not we become a government again? And what do they think about A, B, C, D, E, F? And it might not be what our policies have been for the last 30 years.
And one thing I thought was interesting, and I don't know the answer to that. If I did, you know, I'd be telling you now. But one thing I saw this morning, Audrey Young, I think, had a piece interviewing Judith Collins, where apart from learning that she's writing a thriller, we discovered that she was talking a lot about modelling her leadership on John Key, which is quite a shift. Before the election, she was kind of distancing herself from John Key, and bizarrely, Grant Robertson had an ad saying, if you like John Key, you should vote for Labour, while Judith Collins distanced herself. Now she's kind of claiming that mantle, so I'm wondering if they're getting research saying, actually, they quite like John Key.
Well, I'm glad she's dropped Rob Muldoon. I don't know how marketable he is in 2021.
One thing I would say, though, is that the Nats haven't necessarily hit rock bottom. It looks from here like the only way is up. But remember, Labour in its first term in opposition actually was quite stable. In the second term, it fell apart. They are stuck with a very unpopular leader. They have lost a lot of resources.
Yeah, they've lost a lot of people.
As Trish mentions, there's an emboldened ACT party. You know, it isn't necessarily uphill from here. So I think they're in quite a dangerous period.
But I think that is the key point. What you're talking about is that really hard mm-hmm. policy grunt, mm-hmm. And not just, you know, a State of the Nation speech is great, but a few one-liners is not going to cut it. And that I think, is what we saw through the last election.
Like Labor, you've got 2.5 years, probably, to bed in whatever it is you want your message to be, or to get past whatever it is you want everyone to forget about. And if you're not trying to hold on to, you know, a middlingly good polling score, if you're absolutely on the ropes, it's the time you can do that and you can try some things. And whoever is going to lead that party back out of the situations it is in is going to have to be cut off that cloth, because just trying to patch up the wounds at the moment is not going to cut it.
And it will take some courage, because it's very, when you're polling low, it's very easy to cling to your base and to get more and more fringe.
Yeah.
And it's actually when you end up being popular that you tend to cling more to the middle, as we're seeing with Labor. So National does have to actually challenge its own base, challenge its own rump, and say, what do the voters in the middle that we lost want? And then ruthlessly target those voters.
Hey, thanks both so much for the short lesson. Off to the swimming pool, I think, now.
Oh, going to eat my play lunch
actually,
now.
Actually, schools don't have swimming pools anymore, which is something I really rue. Bring back, there you are, National. Bring back school swimming pools.
There's a policy.
Okay.